Good. I got all the time in the world today.
Hello.
Hello, Soraya. It's Jeff.
All right. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Today we're going to have an interesting talk.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're going
to 100%.
You want to tell our listeners who we're going to be talking to without a full introduction, but...
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Pat Thomas today. I'm really looking forward to that.
Cool. Yeah, let's get started.
Sounds good.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a grubiar.
Let's get groovy.
Joining us today is someone whose resume alone could cover 3 shows, if not more. He's someone we've been really looking forward to speaking with. And before just jumping in and the getting to talking with him, we want to let you know a little bit about him. One, he's a prolific writer with books that span topics from Jerry Rubin to protest music of the Black Panther Party, as well as other critical pieces and reviews. Also a prolific musician with his own solo work and work with bands like Absolute Grey and Mushroom. And also a prolific producer with well over 100 projects, projects from his own label, Heyday Records, as well as with other labels, including the most recent reissue released on Omnivore Recordings, Permanent Green Lights Hallucinations. Previously a reissue for the Bangles, ladies and gentlemen, the Bangles. And soon, a reissue of the Dream Syndicate's Days of Wine and Roses. And just to give you a little idea about some of his production work in the past for artists and bands like Game Theory, Flaming Groovies, Grandmaster Flash, Tim Buckley, Allen Ginsberg, Sly Stone, and even Milton Nascimento. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Pat Thomas.
Woo! Yay!
Finally!
Finally, yes. For our listeners out there, we've been threatening to do this for about 6 months, and today's the day.
Today's the day. I feel exhausted after listening to that introduction.
Yeah, I need to take a little rest. I need to take a 5-minute break. We'll be back.
Yeah, so Pat, obviously you're juggling so many different creative projects from production to writing, creating music, and rather than go through your entire life chronologically, we wanted to bucket your activities by type, so we wanted to start off talking about your reissue production work. You recently announced a reissue project for the Dream Syndicate that includes Days of Wine and Roses, their debut EP, and Steve Wynn's 15 Minutes 7-inch. I'm super excited about this, as you know. Can you tell our listeners what went into putting this together and why they need to look forward to this?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, you know, the Days of Wine and Roses originally came out on Slash, you know, decades ago, and then Slash sold their company to Warner Music Group. And so for many years, you know, Carl Pacoda, of course, left the band decades ago, and Kendra Smith left decades ago. And even Steve as a member, like, you know, it was hard to get royalty statements and accounting statements. So basically, there was a bunch of lawyers got together, and the Dream Syndicate now own that record again themselves.
Ooh.
And so all 4 band members are getting paid, you know, Carl Pacoda, Kendra Smith, Dennis Stuck, Steve Wynn. So all 4 members are very excited about that. The 4-song EP is something that the band released themselves before the Days of Wine and Roses. It's got an all-green cover. It's got the original version of When You Smile, the original version of That's What You Always Say, a song called Sure Thing, and another one. Goddamn, I'm blanking. But anyway, that has weirdly not been in print on vinyl since it first came out decades ago. You know, it's been on a few CDs as bonus tracks. But and then the most rare thing is this 15-minute single just before Steve Wynn formed the Dream Syndicate. He put out basically a solo 7-inch, and that's never been re-released. Again, it was on CD for a few minutes as a bonus track somewhere. But even that happened about 15 or 20 years ago. And the other cool thing is I've got brand new interview with Kendra Smith. It's the first time that she's really ever spoken about her days in the band. I also have the first ever interview with Chris D, the producer of the Days of White Roses. Strangely, he's never been interviewed. And I also interviewed Paul Cutler. Now, some people remember Paul Cutler is the guy who replaced Carl Pakoda, but I didn't interview him about that. I interviewed him because he engineered and recorded that four-song EP. And then the last thing to geek out on is Dennis Duck has always been the band's archivalist in terms of keeping all the original photos, press kits, reviews. And so there's all kinds of groovy ephemera inside the package. So anyway, there you have it, folks. 2 12-inches and a 7-inch and a ton of other extras, all coming out on Record Store Day through a new label called Fire Records America. And that's distributed by Light in the Attic Records, which many of our listeners probably know.
Yes, absolutely. I'm super excited for this.
I think we all are. Now it's just about fighting the line on Record Store Day. But
Yeah, exactly. I think this is one of those things that'll probably be floating around after for those who miss it. But I can't say for sure. So,
well, we're just excited to have it and want it in our grubby little hands. Pat, I also wanted to ask about, you know, we've covered before Permanent Green Light's Hallucination compilation on our 6th episode, another project that you produced. Can you talk to us a little bit about how this project came together and what it was like putting it together?
Well, I'm going to be frank and admit this, and some of my listeners will probably be throwing eggs at me. I didn't really pay much attention to Permanent Green Light when they were around the first time around. I was a huge 3 o'clock fan, but for whatever reason, I didn't pick up the Permanent Green Light records, and they rarely, if ever, played in San Francisco where I lived. So when Matt Devine called me up out of the blue and said, would you like to do this? You know, my main curiosity was the fact that it was a Michael Curcio thing. And along the way, I became very good friends with Matt Devine, and we sort of tag-teamed the project, you know, in terms of picking the songs and things like that. And then, you know, I had the idea, or we both had the idea, I can't remember, but to kind of turn it into an oral history rather than just have somebody write liner notes. So, you know, we interviewed or got quotes from, I don't know, about 25 people. And so, you know, you really get a sense of the history of the band from the notes and that kind of thing. But, you know, projects are different. You know, with the Dream Syndicate, they kind of just leave me alone and let me do my thing. With this one, you know, Matt really took the lead, and I kind of wanted him to take the lead because, you know, he was in the band and I wasn't. And so, you know, I really kind of co-birthed it with him.
Nice.
Well, it's interesting that you weren't super familiar with Permanent Green Light when they came out, because we just recently had a podcast with 4 of us, and we're huge fans of the band now. None of us really knew the band at the time when they came out, so this reissue...
Oh, good.
This reissue is really important because there's great music on here that I think a lot of us, even big fans of this scene, weren't even aware of this music at the time, so I think this Hallucination was a really important release.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Well, I don't feel so bad admitting that I didn't really pay attention. I'm happy to hear that others didn't pay attention. But as you said, more importantly, you know, all their best songs are now in one place, easy to find, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, that was a fun one.
And it sounds fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, it does. It's a very meaty sounding release for sure.
100%.
It fits the music perfectly. So, Pat, another compilation that you worked on that Soraya mentioned at the top of the episode was The Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bangles. And that included the band's first single, their debut EP, a track from a compilation, some demos, live tracks. You threw all kinds of stuff on there.
Yeah.
How was it working with The Bangles to put this one together?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I kind of just dealt with 2 Bangles. I dealt a lot with Vicky, who was the most interested in seeing this thing happen. And of course, you know, I dealt a lot with Annette, but keep in mind that Annette had not been in the band in many, many, many years. And one of the things I'm very proud of is Annette wound up rejoining the band because of this album, right?
Yes.
You know, I think it was Sue who thought, well, this is cool, you know, let's bring Annette back in. So I'm very proud of whatever role I played in getting Annette back into the Bangles. So, Annette had a lot of photographs and things. She had that front cover photo. There was originally going to be a bunch of photos on the inside, and without getting into too much, let's just say for whatever reason, some of the other Bangles didn't want those photos to be used, but they were fun. Vicky was really the driving force coming from, you know, Vicky, Debbie, and Sue. And, you know, it's just great to have that stuff finally, you know, out. So that's the story behind that one.
So, Pat, you know, Jeff and I are just, you know, we love to just pick away at your memories and your brain. And you're credited as producing well over 100 different projects, releases on Omnivore Recordings, Light in the Attic, Future Days Recording, Water, Edsel Records, Real Gone Music, and your own label, Heyday. Do you have a favorite release that you've produced?
Well, one of my favorite releases is, some of our listeners should be familiar with Barbara Manning.
Yes.
Barbara Manning was in a band called 28th Day back in the 80s that was produced by Russ Tolman of True West. So she has a kind of a connection to this whole Paisley scene. But her first solo album was called Scissors. And I was a huge 28th Day fan. I was living in Rochester, New York, which is where Absolute Grey was based. And Barbara was a little bit of an Absolute Grey fan, and I was a 28th Day fan. So I moved to San Francisco around Halloween 1987. She was one of the first people I met and hung out with, and she started playing me, you know, some of these songs that would later turn up on Scissors. And I've always thought that Scissors was one of these great, you know, sort of slightly pop, slightly psychedelic, slightly folky albums. So that one I'm very proud of. I'm kind of have a little bit of a brain fart.
Okay. Over 100 projects? Yeah, okay. It's fine.
Yeah. Some of the other things I'm proud of, you know, aren't really in this genre. For example, I did a 3-CD box set of the legendary beatnik poet Allen Ginsberg singing. Mm-hmm. And he's singing with Bob Dylan and all other kinds of people. Those recordings were made many years ago in the 1970s, but they've never been properly put together in a box. And so I did that for Omnivore. You know, in terms of Dream Syndicate, I know we just talked about this big thing, but probably the coolest thing I did with the Dream Syndicate was get them. I put out something called The Days Before Wine and Roses, which is a live recording from KPFK in 1982, and that had circulated as a bootleg for years. And I convinced Steve Wynn to put that out. In fact, we've put it out a few times, most recently on Omnivore. It's called Dream Syndicate: The Day Before Wine and Roses, live at KPFK, September 5th, 1982. And, you know, it's got songs, you know, plus like Season of the Witch, mm-hmm. and the Buffalo Springfield's Mr. Soul. It's just probably the early Dream Syndicate. They're most visceral and exciting. So I'm pretty proud of that. Years ago, I worked with the Rain Parade on something called Demolition, which is unfortunately long out of print, but it's a collection of what might have been their fourth album if they'd made one, and some other odds and ends. And that's something that me and Matt Pucci and Stephen Roback put together. That came out, God, that's a long time ago now, like 1990 or something. Of course, I did the 3 o'clock compilation, you know, sort of the hits and rarities. What's the name of that, guys? Help me out here.
The Hidden World Revealed.
Yeah, so that came out in a couple different versions, right? There was a vinyl version and a cassette version.
I didn't really have anything to do with the vinyl and the cassette, but the CD is probably the most definitive version. It's got the most songs on it. But, you know, I've known Danny Bonnier on and off for years, and he kind of brought that project to me. So, there's been a lot. The Continental Drifters, which is kind of a super group with Vicki Peterson, Peter Hall-Sapple, Mark Walton from the Dream Syndicate, Susan Cowsill. So there's a 2-CD set that I did for Omnivore for them. So, yeah, there's quite a few things that I've, you know, happy to have worked on.
You were also involved with the Game Theory reissues, correct?
Yeah, the Game Theory thing, I never really knew Scott Miller. I met him once or twice, but, he didn't really know me. But I was friends with Gil Ray, the drummer, who unfortunately died of cancer recently. And after Scott's unfortunate death, it just felt like these records really needed to come out again. They were all owned by Scott's former manager. And so we just kind of went to him, and he was eager to help us. The most important person in that story is really a guy named Dan Valor. Dan Valor was, sort of Game Theory's, not only their biggest fan, but he was a roadie and a tour manager. And Dan kind of had all the tapes that were not the official albums, if you follow what I mean. So, we have the reel-to-reel master tapes from Scott's former manager, but Dan had a pile of cassettes, as high as the Empire State Building.
Wow.
And Dan, dug deep, and, all of those albums, as you guys know, are packed with bonus tracks.
Right.
So I was kind of the midwife on that one. I kind of was the middleman between Omnivore and Dan, and worked with, the manager and just kind of, mentored that whole thing.
Wow.
I also, my favorite, everyone says that Lolita Nation is the great album. I will fight to the death that it's Real Nighttime.
I'm with you.
And in fact, I love Real Nighttime so much that I wrote the liner notes for that one. I actually interviewed Mitch Easter, and there's a conversation between me and Mitch as the liner notes, because I think that's their crowning achievement, in my opinion.
I would agree.
Thank you.
So, in my mind, the natural follow-up would be a Loud Family reissue campaign, but I haven't heard anything about that. Do you have any influence on that happening?
Well, I'll just say that there's obviously fans like yourself that would love to see it happen. I hate to say this, I'm not sure there's enough of a demand to do each and every individual album.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would probably make more sense to maybe do something like a 2-CD set, maybe like a best of on disc one and all unreleased on disc two. There's no official plan for that. What I can tell you is that Omnivore and me and Dan are working on, and it will be coming out at some point, kind of what could have been Game Theory's final album back around 1990.
Oh, wow.
At one point, Michael Curcio was in the band. So there's a collection of demos and live material and various goodies. And so, fans can look forward to one more, Game Theory type project for sure.
Well, I'm hearing this first right now. This is good news, Pat. Good
yeah,
news.
You are. I don't think I've really told anybody. So there you go. There's your scoop.
Well, Pat, Soraya mentioned earlier that you ran your own label, and I think it was in 1988 that you founded Heyday Records. I was just going to say that the Rolling Stone called the label one of the most adventurous small labels in the world.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far.
Yeah. So in the early years of the label, several artists that interest us were released on that label.
Yeah, let me just give you a little quick history of that label. So I was in a band. I was the drummer of a band called Absolute Gray in the mid-80s, and we were in Rochester, and we were playing, kind of our own version of Paisley Underground. We were a four-piece band with a female singer, And so we opened for the Dream Syndicate in Rochester. We opened for the Rain Parade in Rochester. We opened for the Long Riders in Rochester. We opened for the 3 o'clock. So you're kind of getting the picture here. And so I became friends with a lot of these guys through just our band opening for their band. So this was all happening in Rochester in the mid 80s. And so in 1987, I moved to San Francisco. And by 88, I started this label called Heyday that was distributed by Rough Trade. And basically, we became the label for all the solo albums by bands that had broken up. So in other words, the Rain Parade had broken up. And so we put out a bunch of albums by Stephen Roback of the Rain Parade. And he was using the name Viva Saturn.
Great records.
And Viva Saturn had, you know, Matt Tucci was on some of it, John Thoman, Keith Mitchell, who some people know from Mazzy Star. So we did a couple of those. We had Chris Kakavas and Junkyard Love, which was kind of a little bit of a super group. There was Chris Kakavas from Green on Red. Tom Stevens of the Long Riders was the original bass player till he left. There was, Keith Mitchell was in the band for a while. Mark Walton played a little bass, I think, on the album. John Thoman from the Rain Parade. So there was that. I then did a solo album by Jack Watterson. Now, most people think of Jack Watterson, the bass player of Green and Red.
Mm.
He recorded this amazing album that came out in the 80s called Who's Dog that has a real sort of Mark Bolan T-Rex meets Rolling Stones vibe. And he's actually a really expressive vocalist. And he actually just posted he's not known for doing solo albums, but he just posted a new single, like his first record in about 20 years on Facebook today, of all things.
Wow.
So anyway, there was a Jack Watterson record. There was Barbara Manning, who I mentioned. Her record had members of bands like Flying Color and the Catheads played on those records. I'm probably blanking, but yeah, so Heyday was kind of looked upon as, you know, Paisley mm-hmm. Underground Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
I later, kind of long story mm-hmm. short, left my own label and went to Germany, and I started working for a label called Normal, or Normal, as the Germans would say, and I continued to do more of these. We did more Viva Saturn, more Chris Kakavas. We put out a collection of Steve Wynn rarities called Take Your Flunky and Dangle. We put out a collection of Gutterball rarities, which was Steve Wynn with the House of Freaks. Okay. So I've been kind of working with all of these guys on and off, you know, God, since I was like 20, and now I'm almost 55. So I've had a long run with these guys. Someday I'll write my tell-all book and tell you who's cool and who's not cool.
Wait, I thought that's what this podcast was about.
Yeah, you know, I called Ronnie the other day, Ronnie Barnett of Muffs, and I said, Ronnie, how candid do you think I should be? He said, don't be too candid. the truth of it is, all kidding aside, 90% of these bands, the guys in the bands are really cool guys. There's just a few people who won't be mentioned that can be a little irritating, but most of this is kind of like one big happy family.
Nice. Yeah. We're starting to notice that as well, that most of these artists from this scene are just great people.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. 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 The other cool thing is, kind of on the same subject, you know, as most people know, Kendra Smith has not made any new music in many, many years. Her last full-length album was 1994. The last time she played live was 1997. But about 2 years ago, I was approached by some filmmakers. There was a film, the film that put Jennifer Lawrence on the map was called Winter's Bone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Anyway... Okay. I was involved in putting out the soundtrack for that movie on CD and LP, and I stayed in a little bit of contact with the directors and producers, and they happened to be, I didn't know this at the time, they happened to be big Kendra Smith fans. So they contacted me about 2 years ago and said, can you help us work with Kendra? And so Kendra and I had some kind of clandestine secret meetings. And she was eager to kind of get back into doing some music. And so a movie came out about 6 or 8 months ago called Leave No Trace. And when you see the movie, she's got the final, like, closing scene song. That song is on, it's now on YouTube and iTunes. It's called Moonboat. Based on that one song, her and I are discussing, to put out a whole album of stuff. So, you know, sometime, you know, not super soon, but I would say, you know, sometime in the next year, you'll see the first, you know, full length Kendra Smith album in a very, very long time. So that's another big scoop for you guys
today. Wow.
That's fantastic. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, Pat, we want to take a little bit of a different path and segue into your own musical career. And we wanted to ask some questions about Absolute Grey. So September 1983, Absolute Grey is formed with vocalist Beth Brown, guitarist Matt Kitchen, bassist Mitchell Razor. And the band released several albums through 88, and including a really cool cover of Dream Syndicate's Tell Me When It's Over. And then in 2003, the band re-released the debut record, Greenhouse. Talk to us a little bit about your days in Absolute Grey.
I grew up, you know, in the late 70s, basically playing in garage bands. I played pretty much every Lynyrd Skynyrd song and, you know, things like Bad Company, a band called Free, and tons of Neil Young. Anyway, that type of music. And so, you know, when I heard things like REM and all that stuff, it kind of like, oh, okay, now there's sort of a new movement of music happening. And so the members of Absolute Grey, two of them were still in high school when we met. And, you know, they kind of wanted to play, I don't know, it's weird. It's not like we sat around and made a decision like, you know, let's play some brand new music that sounds like REM. But it just kind of was like, you know, happening in the air. And so I hooked up with them and we, started recording stuff in like 83, 84 and self-released an album called Greenhouse, you know, that had a little bit of a, you know, kind of Paisley vibe. besides being the drummer, I've always had the biggest mouth. And so, you know, I just sort of was the manager. Got us, you know, I mentioned all those bands we opened up for, West Coast bands. And then we were on a little label called Midnight Records, and we did a couple more albums, including some listeners must know a band called The Windbreakers, which is Tim Lee and Bobby Sutliff.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a bunch of albums produced by Mitch Easter in the 80s, you know, kind of sound like the DBs and Less Active, kind of pop, southern pop. Anyway, our second album was produced by Tim Lee. And, you know, we toured, we opened up for band. We played with bands like Salem 66. In fact, some people would compare our sound a little bit to them with female vocals. Some people might say we sound a little bit like Wednesday Week. So anyway, yeah, that was a fun time in our lives. Unfortunately, because we were based in Rochester, you know, not so many people heard about us. If we'd been in New York or Boston or San Francisco or LA, I think we would have had a little more success. We did okay. Magazines like Bucket Full of Brains loved us. The Bob magazine, you know, wrote about us. So yeah, it was just fun being part of that energy that we all knew and loved from like between about 84 and 1990.
Yeah, those records are definitely worth seeking out, I would say to our listeners. That reissue is probably a good place to start, in my opinion, for Greenhouse.
I want to say to the listeners, I'm sitting on a case of Absolute Grey Greenhouse CDs with a bonus live disc. So if you can track me down, you know, happy to sell, you know, them at a reasonable price, whoever wants one. So,
yeah.
All right. Care to share an email address or a website? That way we know.
We can do an email address. It's blackbeauty989, just like it sounds. So, you know, black, like the color, beauty, the word beauty, and then the numerals 989 at hotmail.com. blackbeauty989@hotmail.com. So yeah, I've got, you know, copies of that Absolute Grey thing. I have some of the, there's a 7-inch single of us playing the Dream Syndicate's Tell Me When It's Over. And the artwork is really cool because it's kind of mimics the Dream Syndicate Days of Wild Roses cover. So yeah, I have odds and ends of some of the stuff that we're talking about. So if people are interested, there's a limited edition Rain Parade live album that I helped put out. It's called Perfume River, and it's the Rain Parade live in 1984. And I have a handful of copies of those left on CD. That's really cool. It's their first tour after David left, with John Thoman in the band, when Will Glenn was still in the band. So yeah, I've got some odds and ends of this stuff. Jeffrey knows. Jeffrey's come to the warehouse a few times and dug around.
Well, speaking of that, Pat, there's a few other things that I think our listeners might be interested in, because after Absolute Grey, you put out several solo albums after the band had stopped recording. And on some of those solo recordings, you've got guests, including members from Green on Red, Chris Kakavez, Barbara Manning's on some of your solo materials.
Yeah.
Steve Wynn. There's several people. I think even some of the members from Rain Parade, maybe. I think Alec Palau played on.
Yeah, that's true. You've done your research. Yeah, I don't really see myself as a singer. I have that sort of Lou Reed, Bob Dylan, non-singing voice, but I do my best with it. And so, yeah, I put out a handful of albums doing, you know, the kind of a Velvet Underground, Dylan type thing. I did actually, weirdly enough, have some success in Germany. I put out an album called Fresh that sold several thousand copies. I got a songwriting deal with Warner Brothers, toured a few times. So I had my 7 out of 15 minutes of success with that particular album. So yeah, there is some Pat Thomas solo music floating around. And then to segue right into that, you know, I've always really been a drummer by trade. And so about 20 years ago, I started something called Mushroom, that's kind of a free floating collective. We put out about 15 albums, and it's kind of psychedelic jazz, Soft Machine, King Crimson, Miles Davis, usually without vocals. Although we've had vocalists, Allison Levy, who was in Loud Family, has been in and out of Mushroom. Alec Palau has been in and out of Mushroom. And currently we have sort of something I call Mushroom LA, which has Juan Gomez from The Human Hands, David Immergluck from Monks of Doom, Victor Krumenacher from Monks of Doom, DJ Bromebreak has been sat in with us a few times. So it's for anybody who likes, you know, to smoke a big fat joint and listen to music go in all kinds of directions. We'd love Mushroom. And we play at the Cafe Gila a lot here in LA. So Jeffrey's seen us, of course, a few times.
Yeah, I highly recommend those shows for anybody that likes live music.
There's 15 Mushroom albums out, believe it or not. There's quite a few.
Some of the titles of your tracks are crazy. I would imagine that those originate in your brain.
They do. There's, you know, some of my favorite titles are Americans Own the Moon. They bought it from the Germans who won it during World War II in a poker game. There's another title years ago, something like, what do you say to a man who just killed a lion with his bare hands and is now making love to your wife? these songs are instrumentals, most of them. And so I don't feel like you need a clever title to kind of rope people into listening, you know. So that's all my wit and humor.
So Pat, I have a follow-up question then, because I really like the idea of this, you know, this kind of ever-shifting collective of musicians and mushrooms, and you know, the just kind of going with the music, these great tracks. So what was the inspiration for starting Mushroom? Like, what was the genesis of Mushroom? Was it just an idea that you had and you wanted to roll with it, or did someone suggest it, or?
Well, it's kind of a couple things. First of all, I'm one of those guys where, you know, okay, like, so for example, this show, The Basics, is Pays the Underground, and we could talk about this for hours. You could put me on another show and I could talk about Faust and Can and Krautrock for 2 hours, and then you could put me on another show and I could talk about Sandy Denny and Richard Thompson and the Third Floor Convention for 2 hours, et cetera, et cetera. So Mushroom was sort of just, you know, I had played a lot of folk rock and I had played, you know, just regular indie rock, but I'd never really played, you know, jazzy prog rock. So it was just living out another fantasy for me, right? So that was one thing. The other thing is that, and this is a little confusing, so I'll try to make it simple. You know, I'd mentioned moving kind of the heyday bands over to Germany. I worked for a label there, as I said, called Normal. And then I mentioned I had this album called Fresh that came out in Germany. And so around 1992, 93, 94, the Germans got really into this sort of American, you know, country rock, whatever you want to call it, not quite Paisley Underground, but sort of. And so for about 3 years, you know, Chris Kagevis toured a lot, Steve Wynn toured a lot, myself. And then all of a sudden, it's like the Germans woke up one day and they were like, we hate this music. These people should go away. Right. And so that's around the time I started Mushroom. I thought, well, God, I got to jump ship here, man. You know, these Germans are not digging this anymore. I saw that as a perfect time to stop singing, go back on the drums, and live out my, you know, prog rock, jazz rock fantasies with Mushroom. And so I wound up coming back to Germany and touring with Mushroom and got a very lucrative record deal. And one of the things I did, some of the Mushroom albums, you'll see it doesn't say Pat Thomas. It says Patrick O'Hearn, which is my middle name. So I didn't want to be pigeonholed as the folk rock guy that I'd been 3 years earlier in Germany. So when I signed the contract with this record company, I said, you can't use my real name on these records. because I don't want anybody to think it's this folk rock that you guys now hate. So it was really fun to see myself written about in German magazines and people not really knowing that I was the guy that they used to love for a different reason.
And then hate it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So then,
yeah. And then loved again.
And then loved again. Yeah. So yeah. So that was. The story's a little convoluted, but I think I'm coming across with the basic, you know, part of it.
That's great.
But yeah, one of the things I love about Mushroom is that, you know, anybody can join at any minute. You know, like we brought Sid Straw up on stage, and she starts singing Ramones lyrics over the top of our improvisations. You know, it's just kind of a fun thing to do. And a lot of these guys like doing it because, you know, many of these people, like David Immergluck, you know, he tours the country constantly in the Counting Crows, where, you know, you have a very specific list of songs that Counting Crows fans want to hear, right? It's, you know, it's work. It's fun, but it's like work. And so when he plays in Mushroom and he can do whatever he wants, it's sort of a chance for him to goof off, you know. And I think some of the other guys feel the same way, you know, who play in regular bands, you know.
Yeah, you could tell how much fun you guys are having on stage. Sarai, I'm gonna have to drag you out to one of those shows.
Shoot, man, he's got me with this jazzy prog rock improv.
Yeah.
So I'm in it, Pat.
Okay, are you a fan of that kind of stuff?
I'll take it. I'll take the, okay, the fat hit off the joint, and I'll go with Mushroom.
Okay.
Take it all the way.
Okay. Well, all right. Okay.
So, Pat, we wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about your written work. In addition to writing the liner notes for, I'm guessing, probably hundreds of releases, I'm sure.
Well, I have lost count. I wouldn't say hundreds, but I've done at least 50 or more, you know, ballpark.
Yeah. I've seen your name in lots of CD booklets. In addition to liner notes, you've also written a couple books, and we'd like to briefly talk about those. Your first book was Listen, Whitey, The Sounds of Black Power, 1965 through 75. And that was released in 2012. And in that book, you examine rare recordings of speeches, interviews, and music from the Black Power Party. What inspired you to write that book?
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town in upstate New York where there was, you know, in school, there was, let's say, 500 white kids and 10 black kids. You know, I grew up in a very, you know, just kind of middle class, suburban white upbringing. And so it's kind of a funny, interesting trip. Like, how did I become friends with some of the key Black Panthers of the 60s and 70s. And I moved to Oakland in around 2000, 2001. And for whatever reason, I just started becoming fascinated with the history of the Black Panther Party. And I was lucky enough to befriend some of these people. And I started to realize that, you know, the Panthers themselves didn't make a lot of music. They did have one band called The Lumpin'. It was kind of a militant version, more political version of The Temptations. But I realized that there was all kinds of music happening. A lot of it was self-released on small labels of soul, jazz, funk, whatever, that had this very, you know, political thing, you know, Black is Beautiful, Black Power, Black Panthers. And somehow I just really dove into this, and I wound up discovering, like, I would just go on eBay and Google things. You know, in other words, I didn't know what I was looking for because I didn't know what existed. But over a period of many years, I discovered a lot of different records. And so Listen, Whitey is not real. It's a political book, but it's really more of a music book because there's great photos of all these wacky recordings. You know, there's obviously some speeches and things, but a lot of it is very musical. And that came out in 2012, and it was a very unique book. There's been a lot of books about the Black Panthers, but there's never really been a book about Black Power music.
What, man?
Look at that Black brother looking so mean.
Look like he's carrying a can of gasoline.
Listen, brother, let me pull your coat. That's no way to have a Black revolt.
See that brother across the street selling those Muhammad speaks? Go talk to him. Let him run it down. Don't try to burn up half the town. Uh-oh. Here comes the man, and you standing here with that can in your hand.
Drop it, brother, like I asked you to, and let the brother run it down to you.
Sticks and stones and kerosene, coke bottles filled with gasoline, bricks and bats and bicycle chains, with tools like these, what could you possibly hope to gain?
Burning and looting and cries of Black Power, Black Power, all types of war cries, soul brother will holler.
Brother, try and think like a wise man. How much Black Power can you hold in a can?
Hey, look at them marching peacefully over there, led by Dr. King. They say Whitey shot him and fled the scene. Carmichael, Brown, McKissick, the late Dr. King. All these soul brothers claim to have the right thing.
Listen to me, brother, and try to understand that what the so-called...
And so, you know, I did a lot of interviews, and I did a lot of, I was on college tours. I actually flew, I was in Norway and Copenhagen and London speaking to people about all this. And then I decided to flip-flop and do the white radical movement. And so some people will remember the Chicago 8 mm-hmm. and Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin of the Yippies. And so I spent 5 years interviewing all these sort of yippie political leaders. And I turned that into a big book called Did It, Jerry Rubin, American Revolutionary. So I've always, you know, I mentioned Allen Ginsberg earlier. I've always had a fascination with the counterculture of the 60s, you know, the like I said, the Yippies, the political activists, the Vietnam War demonstrators, the Black Panthers. And so I'm really proud of the fact that I was able to get out two big giant coffee table books about these two very important movements. And that's probably, to be honest, as much as I love sitting around talking about, you know, the Long Riders or something, I have to admit that, you know, this political stuff for me as I get older is more meaningful to me. You know, it's more of who I am inside, I think.
You know, Pat, I have a follow-up to that, just to piggyback on this book.
Sure.
I'm really intrigued about how you were able to get the rare recordings. And it also kind of harkens back to something you mentioned earlier about an interesting project that you worked on was Allen Ginsberg singing and, you know, singing with Dylan. Is it hard? Uh-huh. Are people open to sharing these resources once you start digging into this project? I mean, because it's obvious this is a passion project. And are people open to sharing these very rare recordings and knowing where they're going to go and how they're going to be used?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Most of us aren't. But he said something once that I love. He said, trust, but verify.
Yeah.
And
that's
kind of how this stuff, you know, obviously when I meet, you know, when I met some of the Black Panthers, you know, like, hey, who's this guy? And I think that my sincerity and passion comes through, you know. So now I have the respect of a lot of Panthers. I have the respect of the Allen Ginsberg estate. Bob Dylan's manager has, you know, approved, you know, a couple different little projects I've thrown at him. And I think I win people over because they can tell, like, I really care. I think the most important thing is to really do your research before you pick up the phone and start asking people about shit, you know? I've had this passion for the counterculture for so long. So, you know, if you figure I made my first phone call to some of these guys when I was about 45, but I'd already invested, because I've been into it since I was a teenager, I'd already invested like 30 plus years into it, right? So they can kind of feel that a bit as you start to converse with them, you know? Because I've certainly seen people who don't know what they're talking about get kicked out of the room, right?
Right.
I'm lucky. I my goal is to be honest, I'd like to do more lecturing, and I'm about to get my master's degree, so I can hopefully be teaching this type of stuff to college kids at some point when I'm done with my master's. And it's probably the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, so to speak.
So, Pat, you've put out these two books over the last 9 years. Can we expect any more books from you?
Yeah, well, there's a few other things cooking. One is I just, with a buddy, you know, Lou Reed, as most Lou Reed fans know, was a very funny and sometimes a total asshole-y interviewer, right? He would slice journalists in half and eat them while he was talking to them. So there's a book coming out next month called My Week Beats Your Year on a publishing company called Hatton Beard Press. And me and my friend Mike Keith brought together 40 years worth of provocative, crazy Lou Reed interviews. So that's one, another book I've done. I also have a book that came out a few years ago called Invitation to Openness that I did with a guy named Alan Abrahams. And that's a collection of jazz and soul photographs, just all these legendary musicians from the 60s and 70s, Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, on and on and on. And those photos were all taken by a guy named Les McCann, who's a pretty famous jazz piano player himself. So there's always some books cooking. I'm also, as part of my master's degree, I'm going to be working on a book about Van Morrison, but not a biography. It's going to be really just about his music and his albums. It's going to be very music focused. I'm not going to be telling you like what day he was born or the name of his parents or anything like that. It's really just going to be a song by song, album by album. My Facebook friends know me as a very passionate Van Morrison fan. So I'm going to try to do a book with that kind of passion in it.
Professor Thomas, we're ready. We're ready to attend lecture.
Exactly.
We're ready.
No,
please, go ahead.
I don't exactly lecture, but I sometimes do presentations and do interviews with people over at Beyond Baroque in Venice, which is, you know, southern L.A. And I've done an Allen Ginsberg event there. I did a Jack Kerouac event there. That's a really cool place for anybody who still likes to read. There's not many of us left, but there's a few.
Okay, Pat. So it begs the question. All right, we know there's at least a couple of books coming to us from you. What else is next? What else are you producing? I mean, you are tireless. We just hear your name connected with so many projects. Tell us what else we can expect from you within the next year.
Well, you know, I think I've heard about most of them. Like I said, you know, there's hopefully something with Kendra. I feel like I let another cat out of the bag. Didn't I? Wasn't there another album where you guys go, ooh, that sounds good? Game theory stuff.
Yeah,
game theory. There's this Lou Reed book. There's, you know, the Van Morrison thing, which is probably at least 200 years away because it's going to take a while.
Mm-hmm.
I actually want to, I realize that there's a bunch of other Absolute Grey records that have never been on CD. I'm hoping to do at least one more of those. And then speaking of, you know, the Pat Thomas records, all the Pat Thomas CDs only came out in Europe. And so I'm thinking about doing some kind of Pat Thomas compilation CD for the American market. So I kind of want to get the Pat Thomas and Absolute Grey stuff out there just one more time, kind of as the last great hurrah on that part of my life. And it'll be more Steve Wynn projects coming down the line. You know, Steve mm-hmm. and I are talking about going through some of his archives and looking at some of his stuff. So
all the while you're doing all of this stuff, you're also going back for your master's degree. That's insane, Pat.
Bravo.
Well, what I'm hoping to do, and I probably won't happen, I'm hoping to spend a little less time on social media and spend a little more time in school. You know, I probably, like most of us, I'm kind of addicted to my phone. I need to kind of, you know, get unaddicted and try to get some schoolwork done. But school doesn't officially start until June, so there's a little more time left here.
So we've got you on social media for a little longer.
A little longer, yeah.
So, Pat, I do have one more question. So we've asked pretty much everyone that's come on the show the same question. We want to ask it to you, too.
Okay.
When we focused on Paisley Underground as a musical scene in LA, but talk to us about how you perceive, you know, what is the Paisley Underground and what bands make up the Paisley Underground, just in your opinion.
Well, you know, if you talk to someone who was here in LA at the time, you know, they're generally going to tell you it's just a couple of bands, right? So, you know, I think we can agree of the four that are on 3x4. You know, usually you'd also add in like Green on Red and Long Riders. I pretty much agree with that. I have a little more what I call the bucket full of brains view, which is the British. Because, you know, it's weird. When the Paisley Underground was happening, most American magazines weren't covering it, but there was this British magazine called Bucket Full of Brains, and they wrote about it all the time. You know, so they would include True West. They would probably include maybe Early Leaving Trains. I don't know who else. So in my mind, the Paisley Underground is maybe about eight bands, you know, rather than like four or five, you know. But I think the important thing to do is to put them in this sort of larger scene. And this is where things get tricky, because, you know, you had, let's say, the Athens, Georgia scene. You had, you know, obviously REM. You had Let's Active and the DBs. You know, now none of those bands were Paisley Underground bands. But what happens is on Facebook and sometimes in even magazines like Mojo, you know, they fold all this in together. And the next thing you know, the Paisley Underground is like 200 bands, which is not the case. One time there was a funny argument. There's a band from Seattle called the Green Pajamas that have a little bit of a Rain Parade feel. And in fact, they played a show or two together in the 80s. And so some guy from Seattle was trying to convince me they were a Paisley Underground band, right? And mainly because, and finally I said, dude, I don't care if the Green Pajamas and Rain Parade did girlfriend and wife swapping. They're still not a Paisley Underground band, dude. Back the fuck off. You know, so it's, you know, I mean, Danny Bonnaire and I are more or less in agreement. You know, obviously his list is a little shorter than mine, but, you know, he and I have tag teamed on Facebook trying to convince people that, you know, the Reavers or Zeitgeist, as they were called sometimes from Austin Adventures, are cool, but they're not the Paisley Underground, you know, nor is absolutely, I mean, if you go on Wikipedia, I think even Absolute Gray might be listed, and God knows, like, I didn't say that, you know. So yeah, so that's the deal with the Paisley Underground. It's you know, yeah. Wow. With the exception of True West, you had to be in LA, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate your feedback on that, and I failed to mention that you even participated or contributed to a book that's called Tell Me When It's Over, The Paisley Underground Reconsidered. So you contributed to that book, which had several bands included in that book.
Yeah, I actually have about, I just realized I have, like, that book is kind of about, it's kind of about a print. I have like 3 copies left. And then the guy who put it out in England does like a print on demand. Now he, for example, he added in Wednesday Week, which I can understand to some degree. He also threw in 28 Day, mainly because he's just a big fan of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there's an essay that I did at the beginning of the book where I say, well, what is the Paisley Underground? And I say, well, in my mind, it's this, but other people might say it's that. But, you know, I remember once talking to Gary Stewart, you know, and Gary's like, well, the Paisley Underground only lasted for 18 months, and it's only these 4 bands, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, dude, if you lived here and whatever, I get that. But I think it's a little bit bigger, but not too big.
Okay.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Pat, we appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Like Soraya said at the top of the episode, we could do episode upon episode upon episode just talking about everything that you're involved with. But we did want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us about the things that you've been involved with. And we're looking forward to what you have coming forward in the future.
Absolutely. We are ready to have the professor back anytime.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's a few things cooking I can't talk about. But when I can't talk about them, we could certainly come back and do a part 2 on some things that are cooking.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Let's do that.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Pat.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye. Soraya?
I love Pat Thomas.
You and me both. You and me both.
Wow. You know, it's just, it's amazing to me because he is just, I don't know, he's the hardest working man.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just look at all the different things that he mentioned and just a cool dude.
Yeah, so all the things that he's mentioned that he's done, but not only that, what's coming and getting his master's degree, that just blows me away. Like, doing all of this stuff and going back for that.
Yeah, that's it. You know, he said, well, you know, I'm working on this and then that, and then here's this book that's going to be a song-by-song, album-by-album kind of overview of...
Van Morrison,
of
right?
Of Van Morrison.
Who has an extensive library.
You know, that's going to be my master's project. Oh, and by the way, you know, this is coming out and, you know, I've got some Absolute Gray stuff that never got released. I want that out. I just love his spirit and energy. You know, you can absolutely sense the passion that he feels for the projects that he puts his time and energy behind.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is just, that's what I respect so much about Pat, because... You know, when he puts it out there, it's because he believes in it, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's,
and has put the time, energy, and diligence into it. And that's what I like about it.
Yeah. 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 He's passionate. He's a passionate dude. And I was just going to say, I mean, this guy has to be under tons of stress with all this stuff that he's doing. I imagine that before long, the top of his head is going to be Absolute Gray.
But please, everyone at home, do that.
Sorry.
Rim shot.
My apologies. But anyways, I'm not going to...
The door was open, you just walked through it.
I'm not going to apologize for having Pat Thomas on the show. The guy is amazing. Never. He's a great dude. he's been part of a lot of great projects. His name has come up several times throughout our podcasts.
Yeah.
With the stuff that he's been involved with, and it was great to have him on the show.
And for those of you just reviewing, if you are interested in some of those CDs and releases that he mentioned before that he has in his warehouse, I want to know where this warehouse is.
I'll take you sometime. I've been a couple times. Bring some money. Bring cash.
Cash only? That's good. Okay, I'm on it. The email he mentioned is blackbeauty989@hotmail.com. If you'd like to see if you could get a copy of these. He mentioned Absolute Grey. There's also an Absolute Grey 7-inch single. And this Rain Parade live show, first one after David Roback left the band. So worth your time, worth your collections. Black Beauty, $9.89 at hotmail.com.
Yeah, send him over an email.
Whew. All right. So, Jeff?
Yeah, let's close her
out. I don't think there's anything left to say. Gente, agarubiado.
Groove on, Paisley people.
All right.
Sort of dive into the fun. Whoops. Oh yes, the Partridge Family. You may be asking yourselves, what the hell is the Partridge Family doing at this lecture? And this is part of what my book is about. The book really explores how, you know, the sort of iconic images of the party, whether it's Huey in the wicker chair or the 1968 Olympics and the Black Power salute, and how this started to penetrate not just the white hippie counterculture, but eventually penetrated Hollywood. And so in 1971, you have this ridiculous episode of the Partridge Family, where they're driving around the streets of Detroit, and they run into Richard Pryor and Lou Gossett. And Richard Pryor and Lou Gossett are running a club that's about to go out of business. And so the Partridge Family says, well, we'll play a gig for you, and we'll raise some money. And this episode gets even more ridiculous, because what happens is that little Danny Partridge runs into these Black Panthers, obviously actors, and they're playing violins. And that's not to say that a Black Panther wouldn't play a violin, but I would say it's more likely that it would be a trumpet or a saxophone or a traditional jazz instrument. So anyway, this whole episode is here for a little bit of humor, and just again to show Hollywood in some way, you know, riding on the coattails of the movement to try to show some sort of radical chic. So now we're going to kind of dive into the good stuff. The Shaheed Quintet were an unknown group of guys in Kansas City. And they came together in about 1969, and this is what we call in the record industry a private press recording. It means that they recorded themselves and manufactured maybe 500 copies. This thing never really made it out of Kansas City. I was lucky enough to hear it. I tracked down their family, and they licensed this to me. And it's just an invitation to Black Power. It's just a great way for me to start the lecture. And so we're going to listen to track one on the CD. So I want to thank everybody for listening to me. My book and CD are back there for sale at much cheaper prices than they would be if you bought them somewhere else. And I believe Aaron's going to come up next. And thanks a lot, everybody. It's been really great.